pleasure to introduce William Bond, who is currently Chief Scientist for the South African Environmental Observation Network and Emeritus Professor in Biological Sciences at the University of Cape Town. He brought the Cape Town climate with you today, which we're all very grateful for. William has done a lot of work on the processes influencing vegetation change, whether fire, herbivores, atmospheric CO2, climate change, particularly in the context of Southern Africa. But he's also been very influential at a global scale in describing the role that consumers, whether it's fire or herbivores, play in shaping ecosystems. And I'm sure he'll touch on some of that in his work. And we've had some beautiful interactions over the last few years. As William mentioned, I was in Shishlui in South Africa a couple of months ago, understanding rhinos and their interaction with vegetation. And got the worst tick bite fever possible. And so today I reciprocated and took William out to Whiteham. I'm sure we won't reciprocate in terms of unpleasant post-field work experiences. Thank you, William, for coming. And just to say afterwards, we have drinks here, so do feel free to linger and have a drink and a more informal conversation afterwards.
Well, thanks very much. It's a bit intimidating to be here, actually, to talk to all these clever Oxford people. But I'll give it a shot. What sort of motivated the particular talk was the special issue of PNAS and also the special issue of ecography on megafaunal extinctions and their consequences. And I thought it'd be interesting to try and talk to you or discuss how megaherbivores and fire work in the contemporary African landscapes as a window to look at the past and other parts of the world. So if we're interested in the colours of the world, how the world looks from satellites looking down, then we see that there are these different colours, and those different colours represent different vegetation types and the major biomes of the world. And Africa is not nearly as green as some parts of the world. It's a lot of these yellows and browns and so on. And that's because it's the grassiest of all the continents. So Gary Polis, a brilliant ecologist who unfortunately died before his time, he wrote a very interesting paper about colors from space. And he said the distribution of biomes reflects the overpowering influence of climate and incident solar radiation. That's really what controls these colours that you see from space. And this might seem so obvious that it doesn't really require a statement like that. But what he was responding to was this maverick paper of Pearson, Smith and Slavkin back in 1960. And these were clearly zoologists and not plant people, because they said the world is as green as it is because of predators. Ludicrous idea. But they were arguing that basically if you remove the predators, the herbivores of the world would explode and they would eat up all the vegetation, and that would change the colour of the planet, and it would be not nearly as green. So there has been a lot of interest in this hypothesis, if you like, why is the world green, and the HSS hypothesis. And Polis was writing to just flatten this idea and saying, look, come on, guys. If we're realistic about it, it's all about the physical factors of climate and soils. But then I was at a workshop with Terborg and Estes, and a book came out on this on trophic cascades, and they said, look, there's been mounting evidence of trophic cascades. These are what happens when you remove these predators. There's all these repercussions that reverberate through the system. And they said the accumulated evidence is overwhelming, and based on this, we need to change the way we think about the world. And what we should be doing is elevating biotic forcing, what life is doing in terms of altering the environment, as being at least co-equal with the physical forcing, the climate and the soils. So that's a statement of intent. We have to change the way we think. So I think ever since Humboldt, basically the idea has been that the world is shaped by these physical forces of climate and geology, the usual story. And this is expressed in a variety of ways. one textbook account would be this sort of thing, where these are climate variables, and these are little boxes contained within a particular climate zone, and basically each climate box contains a unique vegetation type. So one climate, one vote. Everything is neatly fits according to the physical forcing. But climate and soils are often a poor predictor of the dominant vegetation in the tropics and elsewhere. But let's stick to the tropics. So this is what we saw when we went to Gabon, this amazing landscape of a mosaic of forests and grasslands right next to each other, forests and savannas. This is not consistent with the idea that climate rules and that one climate equals one vote, one vegetation type. Here's another example. This is where we do a lot of our work in Shishui and Orphelosi. And you have grasslands, savannas, forests, and what we call thicket, all in the same landscape and the same geology, sharing this environment. And they're very, very different, extraordinarily different systems with different biota, different biodiversity. And the usual argument has been for many years that these open habitats are caused by deforestation. When Iron Age farmers arrived in Africa, they chopped the forest down, or they burnt it down and replaced it with these grasslands. Well, we've done analyses here using carbon isotopes, and it's just the reverse. In fact, the grasslands and savannas are ancient, and the forests are new. They've invaded the grassland space. So our grasslands here are at least 100,000 years old, and the forests are a mere couple of thousand. So we got it all wrong, completely wrong. And these grasslands and forests are ancient systems staring at each other across a couple of meters, and have evolved and developed in completely different ways, at least in parts. And they're not a rarity, it's the norm for large areas of the world. So whoops, are the textbooks wrong, or are the textbooks changing? Whitaker, back in the 70s, this is the same idea of looking at the major climate variables, temperature and precipitation, developed very simply. And within that temperature-precipitation plane, you can locate the major vegetation types of the world. But Whitaker was uneasy with this particular climate envelope because he said you could get anything there. It could be tall forest, could be grasslands, could be a savanna, could be a thorny woodland. You didn't know what you were going to find. And I've called this climate zone ecosystems uncertain. It tends to be the warmer areas and the drier areas. It looks a fairly small space on that plane, but if you map that climate envelope around the world, this actually covers a vast area. It's huge. So we're uncertain about where climate and how climate determines vegetation over very large chunks of the world. In the Southern Hemisphere, South America, look at Africa massively, and also large parts of Australia. Climate is not a good predictor. It could be other things going on. I'm intrigued by the Northern Hemisphere and why people are so convinced that climate controls everything, which is a Northern Hemisphere. It's a European and Eastern American idea, which I don't know why climate is apparently a good predictor in the North, but not in the South. I've got some ideas, but anyway. So one could say, well, if it's not climate, what is it? And what is preventing forests from developing where the climate is warm enough and wet enough to support trees? So this is what you could get. That's the potential woody biomass. And what you actually see might be something much less than that. And is the difference between the potential from climate and what you see controlled by consumers? Consumers of plant biomass. And that's the question. And you can see that the response variable here is structure. Yadvinda and others have done very elegant work on nutrients and other aspects of the mega herbivore response in terms of ecosystem. We've been looking at structure, the contrast between very wooded vegetation and open sunlit habitats. So which consumers would they be? And again, on the theme of the mega herbivores, the ideas have been that animals that are too big for predators to control. would escape predation, and they would be very influential. And these would be creatures like elephants, rhinoceros, hippo, and so on. And in the past, the mammoths and the mastodons. But it's not only the very big animals, it could also be the animals that make large herds. Things like buffalo and bison, for example. You might have seen, if you haven't seen it in nature, it's fun to look at YouTube and look at what happens to lions when they take on a herd of buffalo. They get very scared and they climb trees and they're quivering in terror, because if they fall down, they'll be trampled to death. So it's not always one-sided. These, and we have animals in big groups, they thrash it. And then animals that are too mobile, so that the predators, when they're rearing their young, for example, have to stop. They can't keep moving with them. And these animals can also escape predator control. So wildebeests are a nice example of an animal that's not a mega herbivore, but that can escape control by predators. So we were interested in fire also as a trophic agent. Wasn't mentioned in the original papers, Thurston Smith and Slobodkin, but we believe that it had analogies. It's not, they're not, you shouldn't push the analogy too far with mammal herbivores, in the sense that if there aren't plants, then wildfires wouldn't exist. If there aren't plants, then herbivores wouldn't exist. Fire has dietary preferences, and it likes low moisture content. Animals don't like dry food, but fire loves it. It doesn't really care about nitrogen content, whereas mammals do. And it really prefers high lignin and high cellulose in its diet, things that decompose slowly, whereas mammals go for the reverse. So it is very interesting, and if you try and protect yourself from mammal herbivory, you like to be eaten by fire instead. And if you protect yourself from fire herbivory, you like to be eaten by mammals. The interesting thing about fire is it has no predators, so as long as ignition sources are there, it should become very widespread and influential. It's also a wonderful thing to look at. So when you get fires like this, Cape Town had big fires a couple of years ago, and the freeways were just lined with people, just as they would be in Kruger National Park, lined to watch herds of elephants, looking at this magnificent, charismatic mega herbivore munching its way across the landscape. It's a fun thing to watch, and like the big mammals, it is threatened with extinction in some systems. So if you just look at the southern hemisphere, sorry, that's where my eye tends to train in, and look at the distribution of fire versus distribution of uncertain ecosystems, the fires are mapped from satellites, and you see that they match pretty darn closely to where the uncertain ecosystems are. So fire is enormously influential in shaping, as a consumer, shaping vegetation. So people might be skeptical. A lot of people who look at soils argue that actually it's all about soils, and the soils control whether it's a forest or a grassland. So one of the ways you can test this is with exclusion plots or fire suppression experiments. And when you do that, there's lots and lots of these experiments. I saw one today out at White Woods, the Charlie Gibson experiments. Was it? Very nice, grassland where the herbivores have access, put a thing up and it starts flipping to a much more wooded situation. So herbivores are certainly influential. This is in Kruger National Park, where it's a sort of the Texas of South Africa, of Africa. They do things at a big scale. And this is how Kruger looked really in the 1970s, and this is how it's changed as elephant populations have exploded, and they've really transformed the system as viewed through hyperspectral imagery and LIDAR, a nice paper by Greg Azza and colleagues, with a massive impact of a single species elephant, we think, on the system, opening it up and making it more grassy. Fire is also very impressive. So this is an area that's burnt annually for 50 years. And right next to it, on the other side of this road, is a place where fires have been suppressed for 50 years. And the savannas are disappearing and turning into a forest. If you go drier, you don't get the switch to forest. It stays a savanna, well, at least the species don't really transform. But the interesting thing with both these examples is that they were in parks where the megafauna is still present. So even in the presence of all the animals, the rhinos and the elephants and so on, fire is enormously influential as an additional consumer. So if you're trying to interpret the ecology of the past when the megafauna were intact, you simply have to take fire into account. And the problem is, how do you do that? So some years ago, I suggested that you could look at three colors of our world. And the green world would be the one at equilibrium with climate. A black world would be one where the composition and structure is heavily influenced by fire. And a brown world would be where the mammals are actually the most influential agents. So where it's warm enough and wet enough, this is what the green world would look like. It's a closed forest, too closed to support shade-intolerant grasses underneath. And all the plains animals disappear, a lot of the plains birds, and you can imagine the impact on biodiversity is massive. This is what black world looks like. If you get enough rain, then you get huge fuel loads, and these can burn every year or every couple of years, or in some instances twice in a year, because these grasses are so productive. And then where it's warm enough and wet enough, and the animals are abundant enough, they eat off all the grass, and you get this low grazing lawn grasses. Africa contributes most of the grass species for golfing, for golf estates, because they grow really well under mowing conditions in the tropics. And these animals have these huge broad boughs, and they just crop like lawnmowers and create these very low grassy systems, grazing tolerant grasses. This is not degraded, or this is just designed. This is Africa, still has all the parts designed for big animals. And it's very resilient to heavy herbivory. And we have this foreign notion of degradation imposed on us from the extinct lands, such as the USA and Australia, completely inappropriate for Africa. African plants are tough. These woody plants here can handle browsing, which is really tough. Grasses can handle things that are really tough. And then you get this situation. Oh. Well, all right, you don't. I don't know what happened to that. That might pop up again. So you have these three worlds, and they can all transition into each other. They're sort of polar extremes. And quite a lot of authors have argued that when the megafauna went extinct, without the grazing and browsing, fuel would accumulate and the world would start to burn. So Flannery expressed this eloquently for Australia and argued that Australia was as fire prone as it is now because of the extinction of the megafauna. I think he's completely wrong. Not completely wrong, he's wrong for most of Australia, but there are areas where it would work. Bernie in Australia, in Madagascar, has argued the same sort of process, where he believed that Galapagos-like tortoises were there in such abundance that they ate all the grass and there was no fire. It was all brown world. Certainly when people arrived and extirpated all the vertebrates in Madagascar, that you started getting fires. But that's the question, is the relationship between herbivores and fire. So if you try to reconstruct the past and think about rewilding and so on, how do these abiotic-biotic interactions change across rainfall and soil fertility gradients? And what happened with the loss of the megafauna? What might have shifted? How different is the world from what it would have been with the animals present? And then what's often forgotten about is that domestic livestock have been introduced in most of these areas. So to what extent are they compensated for the loss of the megafauna? Africa is a good place to look because we have good examples of intact megafauna. And this is one of the papers from the PNAS special issue from Svenning and Al. And this is how the world did look in terms of their reconstructions. And there are lots of reds here. you look at Africa, the reds and the different groupings of animals. And if you look here, this is how the world has changed, and you see lots of blues in most places of the world. But Africa still has these warm colors of reds and yellows, indicating that there's still areas where we have an intact megafauna. And we could ask the question from Africa, well, so how did the world change when these things went extinct? So we've been trying to do this, and the first challenge is to try and reconstruct the African fauna as it was before the massive population explosion that we see in the last century. So this is the work of Gareth Hempson largely, but also with myself and Sally Archibald. And reconstructing what different herbivore surfaces would have been based on the census data from national parks, and then knowing where those parks are, extrapolating the environmental range of those parks to produce maps of the herbivores of Africa as they would have been 1,000 years ago. So the first thing to notice, this is just total herbivore biomass, is that it's not evenly spread across the continent. There are hot spots and there are cool spots where there's very little herbivory. The second thing to notice is that different herbivore groups have different areas where they dominate. So this is small non-social browsers. So these are little dikers and things, and they occur in the forests of Central Africa and West Africa. That's where they dominate. These things would include impala, medium-sized social mixed diet feeders. So these are different functional categories based on their social behavior and their diet and their body size. And these animals are the equivalent of deer and goats. So this is hot spots of browsing activity in Africa. These are large browsers, things like kudu and so on. And then the grazers, such as which are most analogous to cattle, have a completely different zone where they're important. And then finally we have this mixed bag of non-ruminants, which includes all the mega herbivores. So the important thing there is it's very heterogeneous. But from this you can sort of assemble the animal equivalent of a biome. If a biome is a thing that's dominated either by trees, are they broadleaf trees, are they evergreen or deciduous, or is it mostly grass, and with the grasses are there trees? This is looking at the mix of animals to say, are there big zones where you can say there's a common suite of functional animal types? And there is in Africa. So there's the forest diker zone. This is the first time this has been done, but I think it's useful as a way of thinking about how mammals interact with vegetation, because different mammals interact in different ways. Then you can see this zone here and that zone up there. These are arid areas with gazelles, like springbuck, that are common. And then this blue stuff is where, this includes the Serengeti and the Kruger National Park, what we think of as being the classic African habitats, where all mammals do well. And the whole bank shooter there, enjoying themselves. And then the green is actually the zone of cattle-like animals, where the grazing effects are relatively minor compared to consumption by fire. So now we're in a position to start reconstructing the green, black, and brown worlds of Africa. And this is the work of Sally Archibald and Gareth Hempson in a very nice paper in Full Trans last year. So this is the pattern of fire reconstructed from satellite imagery of the last 10 to 12 years. It's still very short, but for grasslands, that's long enough. And that shows us the black world where you get a lot of area burnt. This gives us an indication of current herbivory, mostly by domestic livestock, derived from FAO estimates. So what this comes from, and I'll show you a bit more in a moment, is how much biomass is being consumed by fire versus herbivory. So
This is an estimate of how the herbivory patterns worked in the past, 1,000 years ago. We don't have any estimates of fire in the past, so we're sticking with what the situation is now. And then from that, you can draw up a map showing the distribution of green, black, and brown world. I'm so envious of these guys who are doing this. It's so sweet. And there's the green world. It's a sort of greenish, sickly green color. And it's the evergreen forests of Africa. But it also includes the arid areas, where you can't get anything more than what you have. The climates aren't wet enough to produce closed forests. So that's the green world. The brown here is where mammals are the dominant consumer. The gray is where fire is a dominant consumer, so that's the black world. Then the blue is this ridiculous zone where it's both high fire and high herbivory, which are incompatible with each other. So what on earth is going on there? But this is the first time we have on a continental scale a description of the green, black, and brown worlds, and showing how heterogeneous the impacts of these consumers are in terms of fire versus mammals. And then just along the rainfall gradient, the mammals are more influential at the dry end of the gradient, and fire is more influential at the wetter end of the gradient. Both fall away because the forests at the wet end, both drop away at the dry end, but with the fire dropping away sooner because there isn't enough grass to burn. This is a very elegant graph of the actual proportional consumption of dry matter. So you can work that out from the body mass of animals, how much dry matter they consume. And from fire, you can work it out from the intensity and the frequency of fire. And this shows that you don't want to worry too much at the extremes of the graph, because not much is being consumed by either fire or herbivores at both extremes. But there's mammals in the dry end, very prominent, and then becoming negligible in terms of how much biomass they consume, whereas fire takes off in the opposite direction. So in many ways, fire and herbivory are opposing forces. And this is just showing that nutrients matter. So at the bottom end of the graph, low nutrients, and right across the scale, fire is a dominant consumer. At the top end, with fertile soils, herbivores are the dominant consumer, right over to sort of half way along the rainfall gradient. And this is the funny blue zone, where both the fire and the herbivores are present. And if you examine it pixel by pixel, what it is it's either fire or herbivores. And that is this zone where both fire and herbivory are important. They can't be important at the same time in the same place. But you can get areas where it's either fire or herbivory and as the extremes. And it's quite a narrow rainfall zone where that happens. And this is at the local scale. I'm going to just show you what it looks like with a fire versus herbivory. So this is a map of Schisterium phalloesi, which is a small park. It's only 900 square kilometers, which is what, 90,000 hectares. And the top end there is the high rainfall end. And the dark colors indicates very frequent fires, juxtaposed with very few fires. And the very few fires is because it's a forest. So it's either a forest or it's a black world. There it is again, the black world. And if you suppress fire, like in this road here, that road was built, the fire stopped burning as smoothly across, and within a couple of decades, a forest had developed in the system in the protection of the road. So it's a very dynamic system. It can switch from black to green world quite quickly. Here's an exclosure, and the important thing to notice here is that this is in the high rainfall end, and there is an effect of herbivores. This is with the herbivores present, that's without. But the presence of herbivores is not sufficient to stop fires from burning. This will burn anyway. And this is true of all the
the high rainfall areas of Africa. The herbivores have to be there in massive concentrations to stop fires. And the higher the rainfall, the more productive the grasses. They can't do it. So that's the key guide to where megafauna made a difference and where they didn't, because fires were already present. If you go to the dry end, herbivores can easily dominate the system, create this short grazing lawn area, and you put up a fence, and in a couple of years there's plenty of grass, and the system switches to a black world of fire, and all the trees change and the animals change. Ah, here's the slide of the really degraded area. But the ridiculous thing here is that the animals choose to concentrate here. It's not like a farm. They can just walk a couple of hundred meters and they're in tall grass areas. And they don't. They choose to feed here. So where do you put this? And what's more, when we look at the fauna, spiders, for example, the spider subfamilies that are restricted to these areas. There's biodiversity that loves it. In fact, this little shrubby thing here is restricted to these bare areas, and it grows into a tall tree, in fact, that tree over there. So there's a whole biota that's associated with degraded areas. Hooray for degradation. We want more areas like this to encourage and promote biodiversity of the bare areas. I'd love to know which other parts of the world have a unique fauna in this kind of system. Well, has it gone extinct when the big mammals went extinct? So has Australia got nothing that's capable of using this kind of habitat because their animals went extinct 45,000 years ago? Do you just get a depauperate version of a tall grass area in areas like this where cattle have mangled the place? In Africa, it's absolutely fascinating. You start getting a whole lot of new species. So what we've done here is looking at transects across the park and using dung as a measure of herbivory and as a grass biomass. And not surprisingly, the more dung there is, the more herbivory, the less grass biomass. Earth-shattering results. And then with more grass on the x-axis there, you get more fires. Well, if you don't know fires, that might be a surprise, but it's not a surprise to anyone, really. But it does mean that there's this interesting trade-off between herbivory and fire. Low herbivory, lots of fire. High herbivory and low fire. It's, I put a straight line through that, but it's really more dealing with two separate worlds of fire and herbivory. And what's fascinating is that species are designed to exploit different parts of these axes. And it's both in terms of mammals, in terms of birds, in terms of insects, in terms of plants. These creatures are specialized. They have specialized niches across this fire herbivory gradient. And I'm sure that that's not uncommon, or it wasn't uncommon in the past. Maybe it's the high herbivory end has disappeared with the megafauna. So here's an acacia, and that occupies brown world, the extreme herbivory end. In fact, this is that species that sits where there's no grass at all. And this is a black world specialist, low herbivory, high fire. And they occupy these positions right from seedling growth onwards. And they differ in diverse ways, but one of the main ways is in terms of architecture. And the one on the left there is what we call a pole-like architecture. And then the one on the right is a cagey architecture. I was looking at Wytham Woods to see this morning, are there any cages around, or is it all poly type things? So there's a ludicrous looking juvenile tree in our savannas making a pole. This is just such a ludicrous pole that I think something's gone wrong somewhere. And this is a perfectly decent looking cage. Very prickly, very dense, and very hard to browse. These are the creatures for which these prickly plants are most successful. Elephants can take these things and just crush the whole lot. The interesting thing is that the spines, it's only the external mouthparts that are, once an animal has consumed spiny stuff, what goes on in its stomach and its throat is irrelevant. I can imagine massive scarring in the, inside the poor beast, but it's the prickles on the cheeks that ward it off. And you can test that. It's and we have our face and our sensitivity to spines has a one-on-one relationship to goats. We've tested this and we've actually published it. I'm waiting to win the Ig Nobel Prize. We haven't heard yet. But it's by far the most efficient way of measuring spininess. And it was introduced to us by Sandra Diaz. She said, "Oh, you mean this?" And she stuck her face in, and she was quite right. So we have specialization of kg and poly acacias. And
the acacias are ordinated along this ivory gradient, which is also a fire gradient. And each species has its own location, and there are very few species that can handle both fire and herbivory.
So that's not a climate gradient, it's not a soils gradient, it's not a rainfall gradient, it's a consumer gradient. Now isn't that fascinating? So with the loss of the herbivores, you'd expect a loss of a bunch of biodiversity species. And with rewilding, you have to wonder whether the remnants are there to be able to tolerate high levels of herbivory. So this is just to summarize so far. At the local scale, switches can occur. So you can have tall grass flammable savanna or short grass grazer tolerant savannas, and they can flip-flop. It's fascinating. You can see the juvenile plants are designed for fire, but the adults are a different species, and it's because during the life of the tree, the dominant consumer has changed. How much longer have I got?
Well, 20 minutes, up to 20, no, less.
Well, then I'd like to talk about, this is some new work we've been doing, which is attempting to explore fire versus herbivores and their role in the origin of savannas, the evolution of savannas. And from isotopic evidence, probably we know that savannas appeared quite prominently about 8 million years ago. And how did that happen? They're not at equilibrium with climate, so it's hard to argue that it's climate change, unless the climate interacted in some ways with some upsurge in the consumers to prevent the green world from forming and to promote this black or brown world. So there might have been facilitating climates or facilitating atmospheres, particularly low carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Under low CO2, it's much more difficult to build a tree which has a carbon-rich skeleton. So these might have facilitated it, but you also would expect to see a big flush of consumers. So if we know a lot about fire because we can observe the charcoal evidence, the fossil evidence for fires in the form of charcoal in marine cores in the sea. We've also been exploring the origin of fire-dependent savannas by looking at the origin of savanna woody plants that are adapted for fire. Then you look at mammals, and how on earth would you study mammals? You know, why would mammals have, what would have changed in the life of mammals to make them suddenly more effective predators, more effective consumers of plants? What would have happened to make mammals explode in such a way that they would roll back forests? We were asking the question this morning with why the woods? What would you need to do to open up that forest and turn it into a grassland? The last thing you want to do is get rid of all the deer, which I believe has happened. You want those deer to really build up until massive numbers. And every time a tree falls and you get a lot of saplings, everything must be browsed down flat, and at last you can turn Wyoming woods into beautiful, gorgeous chalk grassland or limestone grassland. Under what circumstances would you be able to do that? And that's the question we're asking with mammals.
could they have actually promoted savannas, or are they mere beneficiaries of savannas being opened up by fire?
So their beneficiaries are not the drivers of the process. So this is the sort of understanding of savannas. At the top there is atmospheric CO2 that's been modified. There's some new work that changes the picture a little bit. But basically CO2 dropped to favour savanna grasses about 25 to 30 million years ago. Temperatures were getting cooler, and with cooler it was getting drier. C4 grasses from the isotopic evidence were trickling around at low levels, but suddenly they took off and covered the world. Look at that, you know, the act of creation.
Wow!
Savannas
suddenly appear in all their magnificent glory, and people start, well, hominids start appearing about there. If you look at charcoal in the sea, it's consistent with this upsurge of savannas. And then if you look at the phylogeny, dated phylogenies of trees that cope with fire very well, they're actually underground trees, they're pretty consistent with the charcoal record for when savannas appear. So everything's hunky-dory for fire. Where do the mammals fit? Well, they're just beneficiaries. So they would have cobbled together and started using the grasslands once savannas were large enough to flip their diet from trees to grass, which the grasses are pretty inedible when they first appeared. So to try and explore this, we use spiny plants, because spiny plants are a unique defense against vertebrates, particularly mammals. And so we thought that if we could track the evolution of spines, we could track whether there had been changes in the browsing pressure from mammals that might indicate that they might have had a role in savannas, or were they merely followers rather than drivers of the process. So we first needed to establish where spiny plants exist in Africa, and we did it by looking at spiny plants in relation to different classes of herbivores using the map that I showed you earlier. Spiny plants in relation to the physical environment, rainfall and fertility, and spiny plants in relation to vegetation. Do they have a preference for open habitat, savannas? And if you look at wild woods, it's interesting that the only really spiny plant that I could see was Crataegus. And if that's in the dense shade, it doesn't make spines. It only really makes spines on the edges. Sometimes quite good. And then we analyzed the patterns at a continental scale to work out which factors contributed most to where you get a high proportion of spiny plants. So in terms of herbivores, they're associated with these social mixed feeders, the impala, the goats type creatures that have a mixed diet, build up large populations of grass, and then put a very heavy pressure on the trees, pounding it. These are the large browsers. So these are the ones most associated with spiny plants. The ones least associated are these solitary browsers sitting in forest environments. If you look at the abiotic environment, high nutrient places, they're completely neutral with respect to fire, so you can find them in fire environments or not. Where you don't find them is in high rainfall areas. You find them in low rainfall areas. And in terms of vegetation type, they're savanna things. So spiny plants, if you've been to the African savannas, you will have dropped blood contributed to the fertility of the continent because of these bloody spiny plants. And if you're lucky, you'll have some tick bites as well, so you can even more.
So that explains the contemporary condition where spiny plants are common. Medium-sized grazers or browsers with antelope. So antelope are the species that are most closely associated with spiny plants. In open grassy biomes, so they are linked to savannas, and in dry regions and fertile soils, whereas fire tends to be on wetter areas, on infertile soils. So good spines have evolved in response to
some new intense browsing pressure? And if so, from antelope?
Antelope belong to the bovids as a group. Well, this is an interesting story because Africa had a very peculiar fauna for a long time. It was an island continent. And the proboscideans, the elephant-like animals, evolved in Africa. And with them, the other major browser were the hyrax, hyracoids. These are sort of small guinea pig-like creatures. But in the past, they grew to the size of a small rhinoceros and wandered around in herds. So Africa had this very strange fauna for tens of millions of years. And then started drifting, bumped into Eurasia, and receives an injection of a whole lot of bovids. Bovids. But bovids are what's correlated with spiny plants today. And this all happened in the mid-Miocene. It's called, let's say, around 15 million years ago. So actually, mammal life in Africa changed fundamentally. So could this then have done something in the way of triggering the evolution of spiny plants? So did bovids, these antelope, the arrival of the antelope when Africa pounded against Eurasia with a new style of feeding, exert very heavy browsing pressure on the juvenile plants in Africa's forests? And could this have changed selection pressure for spines while at the same time rolling back the ancestral forests? So we used a phylogeny based on DNA barcoding of nearly 2,000 species of trees. And the phylogeny was dated with fossils. And then we tried to compare the evolution of the spiny plants with the evolution of the bovids, the antelope, that are most associated with spiny plants. And the bovid phylogeny was from a guy, Beebe, new phylogeny that published in 2015. And that's what it looks like.
So that's what happened to the bovids when they arrived in Africa. Just this massive diversification, absolute explosion. This is the diversification of the non-spiny trees in the phylogeny. And then
that's what happened with the spiny trees. I'm afraid the very clever animations are not mine.
Tristan Charles Dominic, who's the first author of this paper. But look at this. Look at this. Have you ever seen a phenomenon like that? Man. Here's the plant, and here's the plant herbivores. Forget chemistry. Boring chemistry. Have a look at structural defenses. Wham! The world is full of fascinating stuff if you look at the real defenses against real herbivores, mammals. You know, insects are just frost of the daydream. They're minor players. But bring in the mammals, and they really have an impact. So we were absolutely astonished at this. Firstly, we were astonished that spiny plants just didn't exist for millions and millions of years. That's when the Cenozoic started, the age of mammals. So for tens of millions of years, there were no spiny plants. Why? Because proboscideans just ignore spines and eat any old thing they like. And then the hyracoids, we don't know what they feed on or how they fed. And all the ones we've got left are this size. We want them this size. They're very hard to reconstruct. But absolutely extraordinary. And then these bovids arrive. This, we don't know what's going on here, but we think there could be artifacts of the phylogeny. We don't know if it's real or not. But absolutely astounding link between the bovids and the origins of spiny plants. And the spiny plants are indicators of savannas in contemporary environments. So look, now there's the spiny trees. These are the African bovids. And you know, the savannas around here, somewhere around 15 million years ago, we already had mammal-created savannas, is our argument. And then fire stepped in and added significantly to the area. But the mammals did have a role.
And this is the most unexpected result that I could ever imagine. I looked at, thought of so many different ways of exploring how mammals might have influenced the origin of savannas. but never this one. So I'd like to end by just putting the ball in your court and saying, well, what controls the colours of this part of the world, the temperate and boreal regions? Well, climate, you know, climate, it's cold here more than rainfall. Large mammal herbivores and their survivors, domestic livestock. Fire, heavily suppressed. Scandinavian countries, it's anathema to burn. A history that's so radically different from where we live, work, because these ecosystems are so young. They cobbled together just a few thousand years ago. Your soils are only a few thousand years old. Our soils are hundreds of thousands of years old, or if not millions of years old. We are ancient systems compared to brand new ones. How does that influence the colours of the world? So I just look at this, you know, this is Scotland. And you see this, where the foresters have done an experiment. Good grief, I thought these magnificent moorlands and heathlands was a consequence of the terrible climate. But it's not at all. It's a massive consumer control that's operating up in the highlands. Now, you probably know all this, but to me it's a shock. And then you go and find a fence line contrast, and good grief. This is, you know, forestry country, and you keep the herbivores out, and all those pines start coming up, proper pines, Scots pines rather than the spruce, and the Coluna, the heath starts going. And you've got to say, you know, that this doesn't look like climate control, and how much of the cooler northern hemisphere is actually consumer controlled? There wasn't much fire going on here. So this seems to be slow growth rates of trees interacting with relatively high densities of browsers, creating this vast, magnificent open countryside. So how much of the northern hemisphere is actually like our savannas? I don't know. Over to you. Thanks very much.